This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. The movie comedy 50-50, which has just been released on DVD, is about a 27-year-old who was diagnosed with cancer and given a 50-50 chance of survival. The movie was written by our first guest, Will Reiser, who drew on his own experience of being diagnosed with cancer in his 20s. He had just begun to establish himself in the world of comedy, working on HBO's Da Ali G Show, where he met Seth Rogen, who became a good friend. Rogen is a co-producer of the film 50-50 and plays the part of Adam's best friend. Adam, the young man diagnosed with cancer, is played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Gordon-Levitt first became known for his starring role on Third Rock from the Sun. His movies include Mysterious Skin, 500 Days of Summer, and Inception. He'll join the conversation a little later. Terry spoke to both Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Will Reiser in 2011. Let's start with a scene from 50-50. Adam has invited his parents to dinner, where he intends to break the news that he has cancer. His girlfriend, who is very uncomfortable around sickness, is also at the table. She's played by Bryce Dallas Howard. Adam's mother, played by Angelica Houston, speaks first.
So, what's the special occasion?
Have you ever seen Terms of Endearment?
Mm-hmm. Adam, just tell her.
Tell me what? I have cancer.
I'm moving in.
What? No. No, Mom, no.
I'm your mother,
no.
Adam.
No, exactly. That's why. And Mom.
Will Reiser, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, welcome to Fresh Air. Will, let me start with you. I bet when you were suffering with cancer, you weren't thinking, someday this pain is going to translate into a good comedy. In fact, a romantic comedy.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. You know, 6 years ago when I was diagnosed and I had cancer, my closest friend at the time was Seth Rogen, and the way that we dealt with it was by finding the humor in the situation. And cancer aside, is we would always come up with just kind of ridiculous movie ideas. And while I was sick, we just kind of we floated the idea, you know, back and forth with one another, just the idea of doing a cancer comedy. But it was really just a joke. We wanted to do like a parody of The Bucket List, where you do like really absurd, ridiculous things like, you know, skydiving with hookers and just things that were just completely outlandish. But it was a joke, and that was really kind of it was a sort of a coping mechanism at the time. And for me, I would think about this movie from time to time when really absurd things would happen to me in my life, because the time when I was sick was actually probably the most absurd period of my life. And once I got better, that was when I actually started thinking, and Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg started really urging me to write the movie. But when I was actually sick, it was really kind of this place I would go in my head to kind of retreat from all the chaos, and I would just kind of think of where I could, you know, all the crazy things that were happening in my life, I would just think of, you know, a place where I could put all of that. But I never actually thought that this movie would be made.
So what kind of cancer did you have?
I had a massive tumor in my spine, and very similar to what Joe's character has in the movie. And Joe has a schwannoma neurofibrosarcoma, which is basically a tumor in the spine.
A cancerous tumor. Yeah.
It's a cancerous tumor that grows along the nerve sheath and then spreads out through the back and in between the vertebrae. And it's very messy.
So how is your spine affected from them disentangling the tumor from the spine?
Well, I had to go through a lot of intensive physical therapy. It probably took about a year to a year and a half till I was walking without, you know, a limp. But, you know, after the surgery, the doctor thought that I would never be able to run again. But 2 years later, I was jogging. So now, you know, 6 years later, I'm still in physical therapy, but I've pretty much fully recovered.
That's great. I'm really glad to hear that. Now, the movie raises a question that I think a lot of people have to face if they get really sick. Young people have to face it. You know, like people in their teens or 20s have to face it. People who are middle-aged have to face it. Like, if you're not married, and if you don't have, like, a real serious partner in life, who's going to help take care of you? Mm-hmm. And in your movie, the character is about 24?
He's 27.
27, okay.
Yeah.
And so, like, you know, his mother, as we heard in the clip, his mother is like, oh, I'm going to move in, and which he refuses to let happen. But so the question is like, is there a good friend who's going to take care of you? Is you going to invite a parent if you have one that's still living, a sibling, or, you know, what are you going to do? So how did you handle that? You know, in the movie, Seth Rogen kind of takes over that role of being the person who really sees you through it.
Yeah, I mean, in real life, Seth did play that role. He was sort of like my Patch Adams. you know, he definitely.
I mean, won't tell him you said that.
I tell him. I've told him, so it's okay. But my mom really wanted to take care of me, and I was in L.A. and she was in New York. And the moment I told her that I was diagnosed, she got on a plane and flew to L.A. We went to one doctor's appointment, and I just could not handle being babied. I just, you know, I was 25, and I was just, that's just, you know, at the age where I was really kind of finding my own independence, and the idea of having my mother take care of me just seemed so unbearable. So I put her on a plane and made her go back to New York, which just, I mean, that just, I, you know, she was really patient with me, but I did not treat her as well as I probably should have. That's reflected in the script and in the movie, you know, the relationship between Joe and Angelica. And how trying that is for them during that period. And that was exactly how it was for me, my mother and I. And it's hard, you know, at 25 to really know how to ask for help from your mother because it's the person you're trying to break away from.
Oh, yeah, right.
You know, I think at that age, it was hard for me to really ask for help from anybody. I think I wanted to feel as normal as much as I possibly could. So all I tried to do was just joke around and make everybody feel like it was, you know, everything was okay.
Sure, and then you get home from the hospital and you are so not normal.
Yes, exactly.
When you're recovering from the surgery, especially your kind of surgery. So who helped out then?
Well, I had a girlfriend at the time who helped. I had a nurse who came and helped.
The girlfriend didn't bail like in the movie.
the girlfriend character in the movie is fictional. She's sort of an amalgam of a few different people from my real life who did actually bail. You know, I think it's a really intense ordeal to go through, and some people just don't know how to handle it. And I think people, they don't know what to do, they don't know what to say, and they just don't know how to conduct themselves. And I think the idea of being around someone who's reflecting back their own fear of mortality, I think that just kind of sends people running away. And I definitely saw that in people who were very close to me, friends, family members. And so that was really hard. So I really tried to, you know, take that and inject that into a character. And that's what I did with Rachel, was just, you know, the girlfriend who can't handle her boyfriend's cancer and just can't handle the pressure of being around someone who's sick.
There's a scene where Seth Rogen's character is trying to help the character that's your surrogate, the character played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt. And at Joseph Gordon-Levitt's insistence, Seth Rogen's going to change the bandage. And then Joe basically asks, did you wash your hands first? And of course, Seth Rogen hasn't. And I thought, ha, that's kind of funny in the film. If that happened in real life, I would just be horrified. Absolutely horrified. Did you go through that?
Well, Seth did actually change my dressing, and he was incredibly squeamish. And despite what you might think about Seth, he is an incredibly, incredibly fragile human being who does not like the sight of blood or cuts or scrapes or anything like that. And for him, changing the dressing and seeing my giant wound was a really traumatic experience for him. But he did it. He just complained about it the whole time, much as he does in the movie.
So when you got sick, you were working on a comedy show? Were you working on LEG then?
I got sick just after about 7 months after we wrapped on the second season of LEG. And when I was actually diagnosed, I was working on a VH1 comedy show called Best Week Ever. And that was right around the time I was diagnosed.
Was it hard to be working on a comedy show knowing how sick you were?
It was a great distraction. I just felt – I didn't feel well while I was at work. So that was really hard. I just kind of would have to labor through the day. But I think just being around funny people in general was a really great distraction from thinking about what I was actually going through. I did eventually have to take time off from work because – just of the magnitude of the surgery. I was incapable of actually, you know, getting in a car and going to work on a daily basis just because my body just needed to recover. But But during the period, you know, there's a four-month period where I just had to keep going in for test after test in the hospital because they kept I was misdiagnosed. I was originally diagnosed with a terminal form of lymphoma, which was really horrible. And then after that, they just, you know, I kept getting passed along from doctor to doctor. And so that four-month period from when I was first diagnosed till I had my surgery, that was really when I was in this constant state of trying to avoid thinking about, you know, what the outcome of this cancer might actually be.
So in the movie, Seth Rogen suggests that you can use cancer as a pickup line to get girls' sympathy. Did you ever try that? Did he actually suggest that?
It was something we'd talk about a lot because people would give me a lot of sympathy. But it's really the kind of sympathy you give like a sick dog. It was less the sympathy you give like James Franco, you know, like I don't know what that means necessarily. But, you know, I mean, I wasn't like people women suddenly found me really attractive because I had cancer. It was just that they felt bad for me. So it was kind of – it was pity sympathy. But
it wasn't sex sympathy.
It wasn't sex sympathy, yeah. But I did introduce Seth to his fiancée while I was sick. And I think that's probably why she's stuck around to this day.
How did you manage to do that?
She was friends with a girl I was dating. And we basically set them up.
Nice.
Yeah, and they're getting married 6 years later.
So he got something out of this thing.
He got something out of it. And it was while I was sick. We introduced Seth to Lauren, and I think it made Seth look like an incredibly sympathetic friend. Which he was, yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Will Reiser, who wrote the new film 50-50 that's loosely based on his experience with cancer. And also joining us, and let me bring him into the conversation, is Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who plays the character based on Will Reiser. And Joseph Gordon-Levitt, of course, first became known for co-starring in Third Rock from the Sun. He went on to make Mysterious Skin, Inception, 500 Days of Summer, and soon will be in the next Batman movie. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much. I'm really glad to be here.
Really glad to have you. So,
can I just have a gratuitous kiss-ass moment for a little second?
Hey, help yourself.
I grew up listening to NPR and public radio in my mom's car. My mom and dad actually met working at I don't know if you know this station, KPFK in LA. It's Pacifica Radio.
Yep.
It's public radio on the West Coast, and so I have a very fond place in my heart for what you do, and I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. And I should say, are you responsible for the fact that your character in the movie works for Seattle Public Radio? Was that already written in when you took the part?
That was written in. I'm not responsible for that. But
well,
I can take responsibility
okay.
if that
I'll
if
take
that
credit
helps.
For it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, why was it public radio that he works in?
Well, I've always felt really guilty about. I'm a huge supporter of NPR, and I've never given I've never pledged or given a donation. I've always felt really guilty about, and then I figured this is the best way to donate some time back to NPR. It's the biggest donation I could possibly give, I think. So
that's hysterical. That is really hysterical. Okay.
So you guys should maybe like send him a tote bag or something.
That is really great. So what are some of the things you wanted to know from Will as the writer of the movie and also as the guy who it's based on, loosely based on, but based on?
Well, there were sort of two categories of questions that I would ask Will's. The less interesting category but very necessary category was more, I guess, medical or technical, just how it physically felt. I wanted to make sure that I looked like I was going through what he went through. And so I would ask him pretty detailed questions of what hurt, where, when, for how long, how badly, etc. And that was always really useful, especially because he was there on set every day, all day. So I could ask him really specific questions, like if I'm sitting on these cement steps and I'm going to get up, how bad would that hurt? You know, and get a specific answer from him. I'm really pleased with how that part of the performance turned out. I think it's not hitting you over the head, but it looks real and accurate. And I think that's largely due to his credit. But the more interesting stuff that we would talk about was not medical at all. It was just, how did this feel? What were you thinking about? And that's really what the movie is about to me.
So, Joe, you had to shave your head. right before you started losing, in the film, right before you start losing a hair from the chemo, you decide to just like shave it. Were you afraid of what you'd find once you were bald?
Well, to be honest, I had shaved my head in the past. There was one other time in my life where I had just got done playing a really heavy role in a movie called The Lookout, and I just wanted to shake it up, and I shaved my head right after I finished shooting the movie. So maybe that alleviated any fears of the unknown, like you're talking about.
I actually think Joe looks really good bald.
Hey, thanks.
You're welcome. You have a really nice head.
Everyone kept saying that to me throughout the shoot, but I suspected they were just trying to make me feel better, that it was a bit of a conspiracy, that everyone had been directed to say, like, make sure that you tell Joe that his head looks nice because, you know, he's walking around bald and we got to make him feel good about himself.
But, you know, you could shave your head and you could look just like a skinhead or something, but you didn't. You looked like a really nice, friendly person.
That was the cardigans.
So, Will, do you still have residual pain from the surgery or, you know, from the tumor that was removed?
I do. I have felt pain every day since the surgery, but every day that pain, you know, dissipates a little bit.
Because it mentally recedes or because it's actually going away?
Because it's going away. Because it's just my body's getting stronger and, you know, nerve endings are you know, I lost feeling in part of my right leg and they had to remove the psoas muscle on my right side, which is a really major muscle. And I've spent the last 6 years rebuilding that and, you know, building it back up. And because that muscle was, most of that muscle was removed, it meant that other muscles in my body had to take over. And those muscles were just, you know, incredibly strained the last 6 years. So teaching my body to kind of use new muscles has been part of that. And also just the nerve endings growing back as well.
Just one more question. You know, when you're in your 20s, you really are finding your adult personality, mm-hmm. who you are, who you want to be. You can make certain adjustments. You're still a little flexible. But, you know, and at that time, suddenly you get sick. You get this, like, terrible diagnosis of this cancerous tumor that's growing around your spine. And then you become disabled for a while as a result of the surgery. You have to build yourself up over a period of years. So how much did I am sick, I am weak, I am in pain, become a part of that new adult identity?
I think that there was less of the I am sick mentality versus more of the anger of feeling like, why did this happen to me? Versus, you know, while I was seeing my friends who were perfectly healthy, like, why? Just feeling like I had to take all these extra steps in my life to feel good, whereas they had it so much easier. But that was really, and that was how I felt initially. I look back at it in a much different way now. I did feel I was a victim right after I went through the entire ordeal. But now I really, you know, I feel like I've really kind of processed that and moved on from mm-hmm. that period. Mm-hmm. But there was a time when it was really difficult, and I sort of felt like who I was, you know, sort of entangled in this idea of being a sick person, for sure.
I could jump in with a bit of a third-party perspective on that question, too.
Sure.
And I wasn't there. I didn't know Will before he got sick, but I've gotten to know him quite well since then. And I've heard lots of stories from Will himself, as well as from Seth and Evan, about what Will was like before he got sick. And the way it's, at least I have it in my head, is the attitude you're describing of a bit of a, I am weak, I am in pain, that sort of victim's mentality, it seems describes Will much more before he got sick than afterwards. The Will that I know is like far from a complainer, far from that. He's a really strong, graceful guy. And that's, I think, a big part of the story that we wanted to tell with 50-50 is the character starts out as kind of neurotic, insecure, and then he goes through this ordeal, and by the end, he's loosened up, he's more able to sort of go with the flow. He's a stronger, happier person, having gone through the you know, the challenge.
Well, Will, I really want to express my gratitude that you have had such a good recovery and that also you were able to get something good. You were able to find something of value from the experience of being really sick, that thing being this new movie, 50-50. So,
thanks.
Congratulations on that.
Thank you so much.
That's really saying something.
Yeah, thanks. No, it's pretty incredible for me, you know, to take, you know, what was the most painful experience of my life and turn it into something that I'm really proud of and, you know, that I made with my friends. I think it's pretty great.
Levitt starred in the movies Mysterious Skin, 10 Things I Hate About You, 500 Days of Summer, and Inception. He first became known for his role on Third Rock from the Sun, the NBC sitcom about a family of extraterrestrials posing as humans while studying them. Gordon Levitt got that role when he was 13. He was already a showbiz veteran, having done several commercials and films, including A River Runs Through It. Here's a clip from Third Rock. Gordon Levitt's family has found a couple of bags of mysterious dried herbs, and they want to know what Gordon Levitt has been doing with them. The scene also features John Lithgow, Kristen Johnson, and French Stewart. The action starts with Joseph Gordon-Levitt walking in the door.
Hey, guys. What's going on?
Why don't you tell us what's going on?
What do you mean? Where'd you find those?
In your sock drawer.
How could you?
After all we've done for you.
Okay, it's not what you think, right?
It's exactly what I think. It's oregano and fresh rosemary.
I can't believe it. You can cook!
You pop!
No, I can't cook, I swear.
And then how do you explain this?
It's marijuana.
Oh. This whole time we've been eating her slop and you're a damn gourmet!
No, it's pot, I swear. I smoke it with my friends. I love to toke up on the fat daddies. Dude.
So, like, every laugh line gets such, like, huge laughter in that. Are things, like, punched up a little bit?
Actually, the opposite. They would have to take out laughs because if we left in all the laughs that the live studio audience actually gave us, the show would go over its 22-minute time allotment. The truth is that people are so excited to see the show that they're used to watching on TV that when we would perform once a week in front of the studio audience, they would go nuts. They really would.
Now, you know, you, after acting for a while, took a break to go to Columbia University. And then I think it was after that that you starred in the Greg Araki movie, Mysterious Skin. And it's a really terrific movie. And it's such a total departure from something like Third Rock, you know, which is a sitcom. And in Mysterious Skin, you played a teenager who's a gay hustler, and the backstory is that when your character was a young boy, he was sexually abused by his coach, but he thought that the coach's attention was a sign that the coach deeply cared for him and made him special. And he had like fond memories of this. So it's a very complicated role. It must have been really important for you in your career to get a role like that and to say, I'm not just the teenager in a sitcom, I'm capable of other things.
Yes, indeed. After Third Rock from the Sun, it was very difficult to convince anybody that I could do anything other than, you know, be in a funny TV show or romantic comedy or something like that. So it was definitely hard for me to get jobs for a while.
I'm sure a lot of people saw you on Saturday Night Live, was it like a year ago, 2 years ago?
Yeah.
When you hosted, and you did this incredible, like instead of an opening monologue, you did this incredible song and dance thing. It was based on the Donald O'Connor number Make 'Em Laugh from Singing in the Rain. And so it's like you're doing pratfalls and you're literally dancing up the wall, like jumping onto the wall and coming over in a backflip. You did that twice live in real time.
Yeah.
It was really...
onto concrete.
Oh, jeez. Is it a concrete stage?
Yeah.
Ouch. So how did you come up with the idea of doing that?
Well, I was a big fan of Saturday Night Live, always was. I used to watch it, you know, with my brother and everything. And so when they invited me to host the show, I was pretty flabbergasted. And I knew I wanted to do something for the opening monologue that was special. And in watching back, a lot of my favorite opening monologues that people would do were musical numbers. Steve Martin did this really good one. Justin Timberlake has done a couple really good ones. The Rock did a really good one. And so I started trying to think of what I could do, what kind of musical thing I could do. And I always loved Singing in the Rain. And I just figured, why don't I give this a shot? Let's see if they would let me do it. It took me weeks to get Lorne Michaels on the phone because they don't concentrate on the future shows. They have enough on their plate just working on the current show that they're doing. So it was sort of abnormal for him to speak to a host that wasn't going to be on the show for a while. But I got him on the phone and said, listen, man, I'd love to do this if you would be interested in me doing it. And here's what I want to do. And it's Make 'Em Laugh from Singing in the Rain. And I've been, you know, learning it. And what do you think? And he was like, well, sure. Why don't you learn that and we'll see.
Right. And, we put weeks into learning it and then we'll decide.
Yeah, but you know, you can't blame him. That's the only sensible position he could take. I mean,
yeah, sure.
He couldn't tell me that without having seen what I was doing, that yes, I could do it. So I took that as a yes. And I got together with this friend of mine, Michael Rooney, who had choreographed the dance number from a movie I was in, 500 Days of Summer. And that dance number had gone so well, and I really liked Mr. Rooney, so I called him up again and asked him if he would do me the favor of helping me choreograph a routine to Make 'Em Laugh for SNL, and he did. And we worked hard on it, and I was working on Inception at the time, so I also was sort of getting help from some of the stunt guys, getting pads from them, learning how to fall. And, I mean, I'd done pratfalls on Third Rock a lot, but these were pretty intense.
So did you have body pads from Inception that you used for Saturday Night Live? Just
yes.
In case?
Yes. Body pads and ankle braces. And yeah,
oh,
I was pretty
really?
Padded up.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Wow.
And
were you afraid you'd fall?
No, you can't really be afraid. It doesn't work. So I wasn't afraid I'd fall.
You probably had to do a lot of stunts for Inception also, because it's a movie about dreams and implanting or extracting memories while somebody's in the dreaming state. And people share dreams, and you never know whether you're in your dream or somebody else's dream. And the laws of physics change in some of the dreams. So there's, you know, like, impossible things that are happening through the film. So you probably had to learn a lot of stunts for that too.
Yeah, I think a lot of the motivation for doing Make 'Em Laugh on SNL was that I was just finishing shooting Inception, where there was this zero gravity scene, and I got into really good shape and was training and did all these stunts. And so coming off of that, I think that instilled me with the confidence to try to do Make 'Em Laugh.
So one of the things that you do, you founded a production company that operates largely on the internet, but in other places as well. You describe it as an open collaborative production company. It's called hitrecord.org. And basically you invite people to put up their videos, their artwork, stories, songs, remix other people's songs. And you've just collected a bunch of movie songs, short stories, and drawings into a collection that's a combination book, DVD, CD. What pleasure do you get from being the producer director of this kind of, you know, open production company?
Well, Hit Record for me was always an outlet to do the stuff that I wanted to do. And I love acting, but acting's different. The job of an actor is to give a filmmaker the necessary ingredients to make the film that the filmmaker's making. And of course, it's collaborative, and of course, I feel like I'm expressing myself in a movie like 50-50, but it's different than writing your own thing or shooting your own thing or all of those creative exercises, which I really enjoy and have always done ever since I was young. I was making videos, and I wanted to put them out into the world, so I started a website called hitrecord.org and, you know, had some videos up on there, and slowly this community sprouted up around it. I had never conceived of it as a communal or collaborative thing, but it organically turned into that over years. People, when they would post messages on the website, the conversation sort of evolved from just talking about the things that I had made to, well, we started talking about, well, what could we make together? Look at the thing you made, and what if we mixed that with this thing that someone else made? And over time, that creative process just became more and more fulfilling and exciting to me. And 2 years ago, we decided to sort of codify this hobby that I had been doing for years and years into a professional endeavor.
So one of the films that you have, one of the short films that you have in the DVD, CD, book collection, Recollection, that you've just put out, it's called Everything's on Fire. And yeah. It features some footage or video of your late brother Dan dancing with lit torches, which is apparently what he used to do a lot. Was he a performer?
Yeah, he's a fire spinner. He would perform and teach also. He would teach people to do it.
What kind of places did he perform?
All sorts of things. I mean, he would do everything from like busking on a street to playing in big, you know, theatrical shows or, you know, all of the above. He threw these parties monthly where musicians would come and fire spinners would come, and it would just be this sort of big improvisational feedback loop of the musicians would play and the fire would spin, and then, you know, the fire would make the musicians excited. Those parties still go on, even though he died. The Flow Temple parties continue.
So your brother Dan died last year.
Yeah.
Of was it a drug overdose?
I haven't really spoken about it.
Okay.
In public, as far as the details of how he died. For me, it's really less important to talk about how he died, and more important, I guess, to talk about what he was like and what he stood for and what he did and how he lived.
What did he stand for? I mean, what you had an, it's great to have an older brother.
You're damn right.
I have one. You know, I just found that just like really helpful because, you know, when you have an older brother or maybe an older sister too, I have no experience with the older sister, but they introduce you to things that you might not have found out on your own. Did you go through that with your brother?
Sure. Yeah. And I think I just looked up to him so much. I mean, he did everything first. And his whole thing was he was just so positive. He's this extreme optimist. And so encouraging. His whole thing was getting people to bring to the forefront the superhero inside of them, I guess, is one of the ways he would put it. And so having somebody so encouraging as a big brother, I definitely think it was huge for me. And, you know, like, it's interesting. You asked me, were you afraid you were going to fall?
When you were doing the Saturday Night Live stuff.
I was doing Saturday Night Live stuff. And, like, I wasn't afraid because Dan was there, you know? He wasn't afraid, so why would I be?
He was literally there. He was alive then.
Yep.
So again, this might be too personal. So you described your brother as somebody who always had a really like positive attitude and was very supportive of you, but always had, you know, an optimistic attitude. And then, you know, he dies in his 30s. So does that kind of undercut the optimism that you feel like you picked up from him?
That's a very good and fair question. No, my answer is a resounding no. I think I don't think he was an unrealistic optimist. And anybody who's got some sense about him knows that, you know, horrible things happen in the world. And that doesn't mean that you despair. And this is definitely the worst thing that's ever happened to me, without a close second, without anything even comparable. And I refuse to let that turn me into a pessimist.
Mm-hmm.
I just, he wouldn't accept that either.
Okay. Well, thanks for talking about that a little bit. So I want to close with a song that you wrote and sing on your box Recollection. That's films, stories, songs collected from your website. And this is a song called Nothing Big. Why don't you just introduce it for us?
Well, Nothing Big was just a song I wrote real quick one day when I wasn't feeling so hot.
And
on Recollection, there's the version that I just recorded really quick. It's just me and my guitar.
Which is what we're going to hear.
And then the cool thing is if you get it, you can hear another version of someone from the website downloaded what I did and put all sorts of instruments to it and made it into a much, you know, fuller arrangement. And that's the kind of stuff that happens on Hit Record. And when you open the creative process up, and rather than saying, like, this is my song, don't touch it, you're allowed to listen to it for 99 cents, but that's it. And instead, what we do on Hit Record is say, well, here's this song. Like, does anybody want to add anything to it or change it or maybe sample a part of it? Or yeah. When you let go like that, you know, really beautiful, unexpected things can start happening.
Okay, well, why don't we hear your version and the remix? And Joseph Gordon-Levitt, thank you so much, and good luck with your new film, 50-50.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure to be on your show. Nothing big, nothing grand, nothing useful, nothing planned, nothing smart, or at least not very, nothing revolutionary, nothing urgent, nothing hot, maybe quiet, maybe not, nothing hard, nothing wet, nothing naked, well, not yet, nothing witty, nothing wise, no big deal, no first prize, nothing solemn, nothing set, nothing much to give or get, nothing now but me and you, nothing more things that'll do. Nothing big, nothing grand, nothing useful, nothing planned, nothing smart, or at least not very, nothing revolutionary, nothing urgent, nothing hot, maybe quiet.
That's Joseph Gordon-Levitt's song, Nothing Big. We heard his version first, followed by a remix of that recording. Both are included in his CD, DVD, and book anthology called Recollection, collecting some of the submissions from his open collaborative website. You'll find a link to his website, Hit Record, on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, Ed Ward reviews a CD box set saluting Fame Studios, the Muscle Shoals, Alabama recording outfit, whose artists included Otis Redding, Wilson Pickett, and Etta James. This is Fresh Air. The world of 1960s soul music revolved around some pretty predictable places: Detroit, Chicago, Memphis, New York, Los Angeles. But there was one other capital of soul that was less predictable: Muscle Shoals, Alabama, a fly speck on the map. Rock historian Ed Ward tells us the story.
Rick Hall and Billy Sherrill were a couple of Alabama boys in their teens when they started writing songs. At first, the only place they had to record was in a room in the back of the Trailways bus station in Florence, Alabama. But one of the songs they recorded there, Sweet and Innocent, became a small local hit, and a guy named Tom Stafford read about it in the local paper. He built a recording studio above City Drugs in Florence and went into business with the two young men. It didn't last long. Sherrill was hugely ambitious and was soon off to Nashville. At that point, Stafford brought a bellhop from the local hotel to Hall and played him a song. They gathered up some local musicians and cut it, and it became a hit.
You asked me to give up the hand of the girl I love. You tell me I'm not the man she's worthy of. But who are you to tell her who to love? That's up to her. Yes, and the Lord above. You better move on.
Arthur Alexander was black, but everyone else involved in his 1961 smash, You Better Move On, was white. That's the way it continued for years. It continued without Stafford, who fired Hall, a huge mistake. Undaunted, Hall rented a former tobacco warehouse and then found a building at 603 East Avalon in the nearby town of Muscle Shoals and started Fame Recording Studios, the name standing for Florence, Alabama Musical Enterprises. But for a lot of the people who came to use its facilities, it also stood for fame itself.
I've got to see you somehow, not tomorrow, right now. I know it's late, but whoa, I can't wait, so come on and steal away, please steal away, now don't stop.
Steal Away was Hall's second huge hit, and Jimmy Hughes was just a guy who came in off the street with a song he wanted to record. Rick Hall wasn't sure it was a hit, so he didn't do what he usually did and try to find another label to put it out. Instead, he released it on the Fame label and watched it take off. Soon, artists in search of a hit started booking studio time at Fame and getting results. Joe Tex, Joe Simon, Wilson Pickett, Aretha Franklin, and Arthur Conley, who had been discovered by Otis Redding, and with Redding producing, cut what could have been the anthem for Fame. Redding also recorded a demo for a song Dan Penn, one of Fame's best songwriters, had written with Rick Hall before leaving on the tour that ended with his death in a plane wreck.
2, 1, 2, ready, play.
You left on the water right now, or when you left me behind. Baby, then you left on the water.
The same week Sweet Soul Music was recorded, one of the biggest players in soul, Atlantic Records, booked the studio for their new signing, who'd been singing jazz on Columbia Records for a couple of years. It was a session marked with violence and acrimony, and Atlantic had to fly the Fame band to New York to finish the song, but it was worth it in the end. Aretha Franklin never returned to Fame to record, but the studio, now anchored by a band that consisted of guitarist Junior Lowe and Jimmy Johnson, bassist David Hood, keyboardist Barry Beckett, and drummer Roger Hawkins, had cemented its place in soul music history. These guys, sometimes augmented by a third guitarist, a kid from Florida named Dwayne Allman, played on countless sessions for artists who came from as far away as Jamaica to get that unique Fame studio sound. Finally, in 1968, Capitol Records announced they'd distribute Fame, and the label had access to more record buyers than ever. And it was just at this time that the whole band walked out and collectively opened their own studio at 3614 Jackson Highway in Muscle Shoals, called Muscle Shoals Sound. By now, Fame was so well established that a new band, biracial for the first time in the company's history, was quickly rounded up, named the Fame Gang, and the sessions continued. Clarence Carter, a longtime client, brought in his new girlfriend to audition. She did quite well.
I heard you've been running around, and I know your old flame is back in town. Now you said your love for her was gone, but every chance you get, boy, you're trying to see her alone.
Candy State was the last great artist developed by Fame, but the studios kept going. Rick Hall is 79 years old, and his ears and engineering chops are as good as ever, although he's turned over most of the day-to-day stuff to his son Rodney. An autobiography is supposed to be in the works, too, but a lot of the story is in the grooves.
Ed Ward reviewed the Fame Studios story, 1961 to 1973. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.